Penguin Random House Audio presents Night Falls Fast, Understanding Suicide by K. Redfield Jameson. Read for you by Sarah Mallow Christensen, with a prologue and epilogue read by the author. Night falls fast. Today is in the past. Blown from the dark hill hither to my door, three flakes, then four, arrive, then many more. Edna St. Vincent Millay.
Prologue. Summer evenings at the Bistro Gardens in Beverly Hills tended toward the long and languorous. My friend Jack Ryan and I went there often when I lived in Los Angeles, and I invariably ordered the Dungeness crab and the scotch on the rocks. Not so invariably, but from time to time, Jack would use the occasion to suggest we get married. It was an idea with such patent potential for catastrophe that neither of us had much of an inclination to take the recurring proposal with too much gravity. But our friendship we took seriously. This particular evening, having hooked and tugged out the last bits of crab, I found myself edgily knocking the ice cubes around in my whiskey glass. The conversation was making me restless and uneasy. We were talking about suicide and making a blood oath. If either of us again became deeply suicidal, we agreed, we would meet at Jack's home on Cape Cod. Once there, the non-suicidal one of us would have a week to persuade the other not to commit suicide, a week to present all of the reasons we could come up with for why the other should go back on lithium, assuming that having stopped it was the most likely reason for the danger of suicide. We both had manic depressive illness, and despite the better and often expressed judgment of others, had a tendency to stop taking our lithium. A week to cajole the other into a hospital, to invoke conscience, to impress upon the other the pain and damage to our families that suicide would inevitably bring. We would, we said, during this hostage week, walk along the beach and remind the other of all of the times we had felt at the end of hope and somehow had come back. Who, if not someone who had actually been there, could better bring the other back from the edge? We both, in our own ways, and in our own intimate dealings with it, knew suicide well. We thought we knew how we could keep it from being the cause of death on our death certificates. We decided that a week was long enough to argue for life. If it didn't work, then at least we had tried. And because we had years of cumulative experience with lifestyles of snap impetuousness and knew how quick and final a suicidal impulse could be, we further agreed that neither of us would ever buy a gun. Nor, we swore, would we, under any circumstances, allow anyone else to keep a gun in a house in which we lived. Cheers, we said in synchrony, ice and glass clinking. We sealed our foray into the planned and rational world. Still, I had my doubts. I listened to the details, helped clarify a few, drank the rest of my scotch, and stared at the tiny white lights in the gardens around us. Who were we kidding? Never once, during any of my sustained bouts of suicidal depression, had I been inclined or able to pick up a telephone and ask a friend for help. Not once. It wasn't in me. How could I seriously imagine that I would call Jack, make an airline reservation, get to an airport, rent a car, and find my way out to his house on the Cape? It seemed only slightly less absurd that Jack would go along with the plan, although he, at least, was rich, and get others to handle the practicalities. The more I thought about the arrangement, the more skeptical I became. It is a tribute to the persuasiveness, reverberating energies and enthusiasms, and infinite capacity for self-deception of two manic temperaments that by the time the dessert soufflés arrived, we were utterly convinced that our pact would hold. He would call me, I would call him. We would outmaneuver the Black Knight and force him from the board. If it has ever been taken up as an option, however, the Black Knight has a tendency to remain in play. And so it did. Many years later, Jack had long since married, and I had moved to Washington. I received a telephone call from California. Jack had put a gun to his head, said a member of his family, and put a bullet through his brain. No week in Cape Cod, no chance to dissuade. A man who had been inventive enough to earn 1,000 patents for such wildly diverse creations as the Hawk and Sparrow missile systems used by the United States Department of Defense, toys played with by millions of children around the world, and devices used in virtually every household in America. A Yale graduate and lover of life, successful businessman, this remarkably imaginative man had not been inventive enough to find an alternative solution to a violent, self-inflicted death. Although shaken by Jack's suicide, I was not surprised by it. Nor was I surprised that he had not called me. I, after all, had been dangerously suicidal myself on several occasions since our Bistro Gardens compact, and certainly had not called him. Nor had I even thought of calling. Suicide is not beholden to an evening's promises, nor does it always hearken to plans drawn up in lucid moments and banked in good intentions. I know this for an unfortunate fact. Suicide has been a professional interest of mine for more than 20 years, and a very personal one for considerably longer. I have a hard-earned respect for suicide's ability to undermine, overwhelm, outwit, devastate, and destroy. As a clinician, researcher, and teacher, I have known or consulted on patients who hanged, shot, or asphyxiated themselves, jumped to their deaths from stairwells, buildings, or overpasses, died from poisons, fumes, prescription drugs, or slashed their wrists, or cut their throats. Close friends, fellow students from graduate school, colleagues, and children of colleagues have done similar or the same. Most were young and suffered from mental illness, all left behind a wake of unimaginable pain and unresolvable guilt. Like many who have manic depressive illness, I have also known suicide in a more private, awful way. And I trace the loss of a fundamental innocence to the day that I first considered suicide as the only possible solution to an unendurable level of mental pain. Until that time, I had taken for granted, and loved more than I knew, a temperamental lightness of mood and a fabulous expectation of life. I knew death only in the most abstract of senses. I never imagined it would be something to arrange or seek. I was 17 when, in the midst of my first depression, I became knowledgeable about suicide in something other than an existential, adolescent way. For much of each day during several months of my senior year in high school, I thought about when, whether, where, and how to kill myself. I learned to present to others a face at variance with my mind, ferreted out the location of two or three nearby tall buildings with unprotected stairwells, discovered the fastest flows of morning traffic, and learned how to load my father's gun. The rest of my life at the time, sports, classes, writing, friends, planning for college, fell fast into a black night. Everything seemed a ridiculous charade to endure, a hollow existence to fake one's way through as best one could. But gradually, layer by layer, the depression lifted, and by the time my senior prom and graduation came around, I had been well for months. Suicide had withdrawn to the back squares of the board and become, once again, unthinkable. Because the privacy of my nightmare had been of my own designing, no one close to me had any real idea of the psychological company I had been keeping. The gap between private experience and its public expression was absolute. My persuasiveness to others was unimaginably frightening. Over the years, my manic depressive illness became much worse, and the reality of dying young from suicide became a dangerous undertow in my dealings with life. Then, when I was 28 years old, after a damaging and psychotic mania, followed by a particularly prolonged and violent siege of depression, I took a massive overdose of lithium. I unambivalently wanted to die, and nearly did. Death from suicide had become a possibility, if not a probability, in my life.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?